Sobel, U.S. Chair, OMFIF. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by a longtime acquaintance, Michael Pettis. Michael is one of the world's foremost experts on the Chinese economy. He's a professor of finance at Peking University's Guanghua School of Management, where he specializes in Chinese financial markets. He's also a non-resident senior fellow in the Carnegie Tsinghua Center for Global Policy. He's a prolific writer. He just co-authored a book with Matthew Klein entitled Trade Wars or Class Wars, How Rising Inequality Distorts the Global Economy and Threatens International Peace. It's well worth reading. Listeners should go out and buy it. He's also on Twitter and comments frequently on issues around the Chinese economy. He was a former bond trader, sovereign debt analyst, Latin expert, and he moonlights as one of China's leading rock music promoters. Welcome, Michael.
Thanks very much, Mark.
So many analysts have written about China's high investment rate and the inefficiency of investment, especially given that much credit is directed towards state-owned enterprises and the like. With a sustained flow of credit, firms can keep on producing, maintaining employment, and also boosting measured GDP. But what I'm calling measured GDP is different than what I'll call productive GDP. Do you think China can and does sustain high measured rates of GDP growth by pumping out credit?
Yes, I give them slightly different names. I refer to your measured GDP as GDP as an input, and the productive GDP is GDP as an output. And it's important to understand why we got to where we are. And when China began the reform and opening up process back in 79, it had gone through 5 decades of anti-Japanese war, civil war, and 30 years of Maoism. And as a result, it was left, I would argue, vastly underinvested for its level of institutional development. In many ways, it was institutionally a middle-income country, but in terms of actual income and infrastructure, it was one of the poorest countries in the world. So what China needed at the time, and China didn't invent this development model, many countries have followed it. What China did at the time was it took steps to force up the domestic savings rate, pour the savings into an easily controllable banking system, and then use those savings to subsidize an enormous amount of investment. And this made a lot of sense at the time because China was so significantly underinvested. It needed everything. It needed subways and trains and bridges and manufacturing capacity, et cetera, et cetera. And so it built all of this. The problem is that when you have, as China did, the highest investment growth rate probably in history, at some point you close the gap between your level of investment and your actual investment. And when that happens, as Albert Hirschman told us many, many decades ago, you have to change your development model, but it's very, very difficult to change that development model. And Hirschman pointed out that no country ever does so without a great deal, first, of political difficulty. But if you don't change the model, what ends up happening is what you see in China, and that is China continued with very, very high levels of investment, but now this investment was no longer productive. They built bridges that they didn't need. They have 2/3 of all of the high-speed trains in the world, and they overbuilt in a wide variety of areas. And the problem there is that you're creating GDP, what you would call measured GDP, but it isn't really adding to the economy. If you take $100 of resources and recombine them in a way that creates $20 of economic value, your productive GDP should be $20, but your measured GDP is going to be $100. And I argue that that's why you can't really compare Chinese growth rates, GDP growth rates, with those of most other countries, because in most other countries, GDP is a proxy, however rough, of the real underlying economy, growth in the real underlying economy. But in China, it measures something completely different. The GDP growth rate is set politically as the GDP growth target, and it's the growth rate that satisfies the various constituencies within China, including, you know, minimum levels of unemployment, et cetera. And so local governments and SOEs are required to generate enough activity, whether it's productive or not, and much of it, most of it is not productive, in order to get to that GDP growth target. And most other countries don't target growth. So it's a very, very different measure.
Well, thank you. That's a great intro into our discussion. So many analysts suggest China's sustainable growth rate is now around 6%, and it will fall to 4% or lower over the coming decade due to demographics and a handoff from investment to consumerism. So if you think China is posting much higher rates of growth now than is productive, how do you react to that conventional wisdom?
Well, we know this conventional wisdom is nothing new. It's happened with every single country that's had an investment-driven growth miracle, and there have been many, at least two dozen since the Second World War. And we always make the same set of mistakes. So had you been asked in 1989 to predict the next 20 years of Japanese growth, even if you were a Japan skeptic, you would have probably said things are going to slow down significantly, probably 3% growth for the next 10 or 20 years. In fact, Paul Krugman, who was a Japan skeptic, said something very similar. Well, it turned out they only grew at 0.5% for the next 20 years. In the late 1970s, had you predicted Brazilian growth for the next decade or so, you would have acknowledged that their debt levels were rising quickly, but you would have probably still predicted 4%, 3% growth rates. In fact, in the 1980s, they had negative growth rates. I can tell you the same story about the Soviet Union in the 1970s and on and on. So we always make this mistake. The problem is, I think, it's not that growth rates suddenly collapse in each of these countries. What I think really happened is that growth rate, real growth, was never as high as the posted growth, the measured growth. So what happened in the next few years, once the country could no longer continue leveraging up quickly enough to maintain those high growth rates, you saw not just a slowdown in growth, but a partial reversal, a partial unwinding of all the previous false growth that had occurred. So that's a long way of saying that there's, I don't think China's equilibrium growth rate is 6% or 5% or 4%. I suspect it's below 2 to 3% at best, and has been for many years.
Well, thank you. That is definitely not the conventional wisdom. But let's dig into that a little bit more. So if credit is being intermediated inefficiently through the financial system, and then you throw in on top of that concerns about investors reaching for yield and the like and shadow banking, I assume you share the concerns over excess Chinese leverage. Many assume that if the financial system is over-levered, it can come crashing down. The authorities seem attuned to the excess leverage issue. I assume they can always avoid a crash and run risk by pumping out liquidity and through bailouts. However, if the over-leveraged financial system is tackled, as we've been discussing, that probably means slower growth. So the Chinese financial system is a huge conduit for this excess growth as you've been describing it. What's your view on the health of the Chinese financial system? How do you see excess leverage playing out? And in the last few weeks, we've seen some local government bond defaults. Some firms have defaulted on their bonds. The conventional wisdom was that the government would bail these firms out, but it's seemingly not happening. What's going on now?
Well, I think ultimately they will bail the firms out. And the reason I say that is because there is this huge debate taking place in China, and it has been for many years, between those who are more concerned about the increasing leverage, the rise in debt. And those are, you know, the usual suspects, the PBOC, people around the Ministry of Finance, a lot of the academic economists in the major universities, and those who are more concerned about slowing growth. And they tend to be, you know, more the provincial governors, the political leaders, the foreign affairs types, et cetera, et cetera. So there's this big debate, and there's a recognition, at least among the former, that you can't get both. If you want a GDP growth target, in other words, if you want to achieve a measured GDP growth that's greater than the real underlying growth in the economy, the only way you can do so is by allowing or encouraging or forcing the banking system to lend into non-productive activity. So when they say we want to eliminate moral hazard and we want the banks to start making good loans, whether they realize it or not, they're also saying we have to give up the GDP growth target. You cannot have a GDP growth target that isn't also a credit growth target. And you cannot have a credit growth target if you want the banking system simply to make productive loans, unless you lower the GDP growth target substantially to within the real underlying growth rate of the economy. So I think at the end of the day, they're not going to let these bankruptcies occur, because if they do, you'll see an enormous pullback by the financial system, and they'll no longer be willing to lend to SOEs and to local governments that are overly indebted, who use these proceeds to generate the GDP growth that Beijing wants. Now, you asked how healthy the banking system is. The banking system is insolvent. If loans were correctly marked down to economic value, all the banks would be insolvent. But as you know, the small banks have a particularly big problem. They have the worst asset quality, and they have a terrible liability structure, at least on paper. It's mostly purchased funds. So why don't they have a crisis? I've been arguing for years that China is very unlikely to have a crisis, because for me, a financial crisis is really a balance sheet problem, right? You have a mismatched balance sheet, and something happens that prevents you from rolling over your liabilities, and so you have contractions on both sides of the balance sheet and all the stuff that you know about. So what about China? Does it have mismatched balance sheets? Yes, on principle, it's got horribly mismatched balance sheets. But as long as the banking system is closed, and basically everything runs through the banking system, as long as the banking system is closed and the regulators are powerful and credible, they can always restructure liabilities. So what looks like a mismatched balance sheet on paper, in fact, isn't mismatched, because they can step in and restructure. So China is very unlikely to have a crisis. I say unlikely because as China continues opening up and more foreign investors get involved in the financial sector, it becomes harder and harder to maintain that control. So in 2 or 3 years, I might give you a very different answer. But for now, I'll tell you they are very unlikely to have a financial crisis. But that's not necessarily a good thing. From a social and political point of view, that's a good thing, because financial crises are terribly damaging. But from an economic point of view, financial crises aren't damaging so much as they are a recognition of the economic damage that already occurred. And so by postponing a crisis, it seems, the historical precedents seem pretty clear, the net cost to the economy tends to be greater. So in a sense, what China is doing is they're trading off a social and political problem for an economic problem. They will probably in the long term suffer more from the failure to clean up the banking system, but in the short term, from a political and social point of view, they'll protect themselves from the consequences of a crisis.
Great. So in essence, sometimes the financial authorities try to squeeze leverage cognizant of the problems. That eventually starts to hit growth, and the leadership backtracks a bit and allows credit to expand again, whether that supports productive growth or not.
Exactly. Exactly. This has been going on for nearly 10 years.
Well, let's turn to some international issues. As you know, China's current account surplus was 10% of GDP a decade or more ago, and then fell close to balance last year. It's popped up this year, I think, on a number of COVID-related concerns. A current account surplus is equal to the saving and investment gap in the economy. If investment is high and inefficient, as we've been discussing, but China has a current account balance or slight surplus, that means saving is extremely high as well. So even if the current account is balanced, this could simply be hiding massive saving and investment distortions, which impede growth. Do you agree? And if so, what are the key distortions to address?
I agree with all except one point. I think COVID-19 explains the fact that China recovered from COVID-19 before anybody else, explains the increase in exports, but I don't think it explains the huge jump in the trade surplus. I think that's explained by something else. Because normally, if your exports go up, you earn additional revenues, and depending on how those revenues are distributed, if they're distributed correctly to workers and to the middle class, then their consumption goes up, and that eventually feeds into imports directly or indirectly from the U.S. or other countries. And that didn't happen. Exports were up in November, 15%, 14.9%, and imports were actually down by 0.8%. So there's something else going on there. And what I would argue is that what's going on is the very different response, policy response, Beijing had to the pandemic than the rest of the world. In most of the world, the pandemic was seen as a supply side problem, but more as a demand side problem. So most of the world responded with policies that boosted the demand side of the economy, distributing income, et cetera. And as a result, you see in countries like the US or in Europe, the rebound industrial production exceeded the rebound in whatever measure of consumption you use. But that's not what happened in China. In China, there were almost no policies aimed at boosting the demand side. There was a laughably small issuance of consumer coupons by local provincial and municipalities, but that was pretty much it. Almost the entire response was on the supply side. Extend lending to corporations, spend more on logistics, lower corporate taxes, lower payroll taxes, et cetera, et cetera. And as a result, China's industrial production measures rebounded far more quickly than consumption measures. So when industrial production rebounds more quickly than consumption, there's only two ways you can resolve that. One way is with a significant increase in investment. But the private sector wasn't going to invest, in part because consumption didn't rebound. So they've actually been disinvesting. So that meant the only place you could increase investment was public sector investment. And we saw that. Chinese imports of steel, et cetera, which is what they use for infrastructure spending, are at records. So partly they responded with a huge increase in public sector investment. But of course, they don't want to do that because public sector investment is the source of the rapid leveraging up of the economy. So the other way you can resolve it is with an expanding trade surplus. And I don't need to tell you, they also did that. In fact, November's trade surplus is the highest monthly trade surplus on record for China. It's currently running at roughly 6% of China's GDP. Now, that's not sustainable. If you're Singapore, you can run a surplus of 6% of GDP because the rest of the world will barely notice it. But China's surplus is the equivalent of a fiscal contraction for the rest of the world of something like 1.2%. So I don't think the world can really absorb this type of a trade surplus much longer. But those are the only two options China has. By focusing on the supply side rather than the demand side, they had to bridge the gap. And the only ways to bridge the gap is with more non-productive investment or a bigger trade surplus. And needless to say, they did both.
Why do you think they've chosen to emphasize supply side instead of demand side?
Well, there are probably political constraints. There's also the problem that China has never been good at supporting the demand side. They've talked about it for a long time. Back in 2007, then Premier Wen Jiabao famously gave his rebalancing speech and promised to rebalance the economy towards domestic consumption. And of course, that never happened. Today, household consumption is only about 2 percentage points higher than it was 13 years ago. And it's still, if you exclude Chinese history, it's the lowest household consumption rate in history. And then in May, Xi Jinping proposed their new growth model, which they call the dual circulation model, which is really a restatement of the old rebalancing. It's been very difficult for them to do that because rebalancing is really quite straightforward, Mark. If you want the consumption share of GDP to go up, there's only two ways you can do it. One is encourage households to borrow more to consume. And they did that. Household borrowing is higher in China than it is in the U.S. as a share of household income. And there's evidence that households are trying to delever, so that's not going to work. The only other way is to increase the household income share of GDP. But the problem there is if I increase my share, then I must reduce your share. And who are you in the Chinese context? You are local elites, provincial elites, and local and provincial governments who are extremely powerful and very resistant and have been since 2007. So it's been very tough for China to do that, although they've been promising to do that for 13 years now.
Well, thank you. So the trade surplus is really the exportation of excess domestic production, it seems, as if you're saying, and that raises the question of whether the BRI should be seen as a vehicle for excess domestic exportation of production.
Yeah, to a certain extent it is. In fact, one of my colleagues, one of the professors at Peking University many years ago, sort of joked about it. He said, as long as we're throwing away money domestically, we might as well throw away money abroad. And I think the throwing away comment is very telling because, as you probably have noticed, the Financial Times had an excellent article in today's newspaper. BRI lending has dropped significantly since 2015, 2016. And what I would argue is that that also was expected. I've been writing about that since 2011. Whenever countries first go out on the sort of development lending process, you know, the U.S. in the 1920s and the Soviet Union in the 1950s and Japan in the 1970s and early 80s, they always seem to make the same mistake. First, they discover that they're actually very good at making development loans, and they're actually quite good at beating out their competitors. And then over time, they discover the reason is because the lack of experience has led them to underestimate risk and perhaps overestimate their business capacities. And in the end, they discover that development lending is much more difficult than it seems, and that you start taking big losses, and then you see a significant contraction. In the 1920s, for example, the U.S. went out for the first time to Latin America. The first American branch overseas ever was J.P. Morgan's branch in Buenos Aires in 1917, I think it was. And in the 1920s, you know, the U.S. feeling its oats expanded rapidly, beat out the English everywhere. We said it's because we're smarter, and the Brits said it's because we were underpricing risk. And in the 1930s, we got almost none of the money back, so it turned out we were significantly underpricing risk. And I think China has done, you know, pretty much, has followed pretty much the same path. The key turning point, I think, was in 2014, 2015 with Venezuela, which is the biggest single recipient of Chinese development loans. You'll remember at the time, oil prices cratered and Venezuelan economy was left in tatters. And China was forced to restructure its debt to Venezuela, or Venezuelan debt to China. And one of my former students works in that process. I don't want to give too much information about him, but he works in that process. And he told me at the time that they were really surprised and shocked by what happened in Venezuela. And there was a decision that there would be no more lending to Venezuela and very little additional lending to the region. But I think that affected their overall attitude towards BRI because they started to see in other countries some of the same problems. It's very easy to make loans to countries that nobody wants to lend money to. The hard part is always collecting the loans.
And COVID will probably show that in greater magnitudes. Well, let's turn to Chinese currency policy. The RMB is managed. The IMF has suggested the RMB is fairly valued or moderately undervalued, and China's external position is broadly in line with fundamentals. Governor Zhou spoke about internationalizing the RMB. It always struck me that perhaps he was using this as a vehicle to push domestic reforms. Some say China may move to a digital RMB, may help the Chinese currency become an international reserve asset. My view is that to have an internationalized currency, one probably needs to open up one's financial system. One needs to have convertibility and decent property protections. And one would be very ill-advised to do so with the weak banking system. I've been skeptical about the RMB becoming a major global reserve asset anytime in the near future. So how do you feel about the RMB, its valuation, and some of these internationalization and reserve asset questions?
Well, it's interesting because the people who are most excited about the internationalization of the RMB and who will tell you that, you know, within a few years it'll be a major reserve currency or that the digital RMB is going to make a huge impact, what they all have in common is that most of them know very little about how international reserve currencies work. Even within China, I mean, you know, the PBOC says these things. I think they say it pro forma. But when you speak to them, they're incredibly skeptical too. It's very hard to have an international reserve currency. And the reason I would argue your currency gets to be the international reserve currency is not because you have the, you know, the niftiest money, but because your economy is willing to accept what the rest of the world needs. And what the rest of the world really wants is demand. They want to run trade surpluses. So the U.S. plays that role, and to a lesser extent, countries like England play that role because they are structured in such a way that they are constantly willing and able. I don't know about willing, but certainly they're constantly running the corresponding deficits that the rest of the world needs. China, for a whole bunch of reasons, cannot run significant deficits. So until that happens, the chances of the currency becoming a reserve currency are pretty limited. To me, what's really interesting now is when you try to measure the inflows into China, they've really surged. You know, not only did we have a $75 billion surplus this year, but this month, but we've been running $50 to $60 billion surpluses since April. And on top of it, there's probably around $30 billion a month coming in into the financial markets. So when you try to compare what's happening this year with the, you know, previous periods, it seems like there's anywhere from $30 to $50 billion of additional money flowing into China. And you would think, given, you know, their attempts to prevent the renminbi from going up, there must be significant intervention. But it's not showing up anywhere in central bank reserves. Central bank reserves have basically been flat since 2017. So the big question we all have is what the hell is going on? Is somebody else intervening on behalf of the central bank? And what does it imply for the trajectory of the renminbi? I've been telling my clients basically since the end of 2018 that the renminbi will be either stable or up. And I think that's even more certain today. The amount of inflows are substantial and the PBOC is trying to prevent it from going up. Unsuccessfully, it's gone up a lot this year, and I think that'll continue. I think they have a real, it's almost become a problem of inflows. So my guess is that we're going to start seeing the PBOC and the regulators significantly relax the ability of Chinese to take money out of the country. So perhaps next year, we'll see Chinese companies once again buying companies abroad and other forms of capital outflow. But it's really interesting to watch what's happening and to try to figure out exactly where all these dollars are ending up, because they're not ending up visibly in PBOC reserves, which is where you would have expected them to end up.
So I take it you haven't found them yet. Well, just to say, you know, when you were talking about the U.S. Absorbing surpluses from the rest of the world, just to plug your book again, this is a major theme in your book on trade wars are class wars. And I, for one, have always said that I didn't think the exorbitant privilege was so exorbitant. There are costs to being reserve a currency, even if we benefit on net. Despite China's currency moves, I thought Trump and Obama before him had legitimate gripes about Chinese policies on IPR, forced technology transfers, industrial policy, and the like. Trump reacted by slapping on tariffs. How do you feel about Trump's China trade policy, and what should President-elect Biden do in your view?
Well, clearly, it's hard to argue that Trump's trade policies were very effective. The U.S. trade deficits and the Chinese trade surpluses are higher than ever. And I would argue that there is a real legitimate concern about the role of the U.S. in absorbing these deficits, and the U.S. should take steps to try to reduce these deficits, whether it's through trade agreements or through unilateral action. You know, that's a secondary, not a secondary, it's a very important issue, but that's a separate issue. But what I would argue is that, you know, the 19th century view, which was that the U.S. ran trade deficits because it had very low savings rates, compared to its investment needs is no longer the case. There's tons of capital. Interest rates are at the lowest that they've ever been. The problem with the U.S. is that investment rates are unlikely to go up for a whole bunch of reasons. And as long as capital flows into the U.S., that automatically drives down the U.S. savings rate. So I think the U.S. really has to focus, if it wants to deal with the deficit, it should focus on the capital side of the imbalance rather than the trade side of the imbalance. And I would argue that's probably what Joe Biden should be doing, although a better thing would be to arrange trade agreements among a bunch of countries in which those problems were very specifically addressed. You'll remember in the original Bretton Woods agreements, particularly Keynes' version, neither Harry Dexter White nor John Maynard Keynes thought an unfettered flow of capital was a good idea. In both cases, they wanted to restrict capital flows. And Keynes also argued, I think most of us agree correctly, that trade imbalances were caused by problems as likely to be in the surplus countries as in the deficit countries. And if you force the adjustment always on the deficit countries, then there's a systematic tendency to reduce global demand. If you force the surplus countries to adjust, then that has a systematic tendency to increase global demand. And I think perhaps we need to dust off the old Keynesian ideas and put together a trade agreement among countries that really address these imbalances. That would be the way for both the U.S. to resolve its problem and to maintain leadership. The other way, which is simply to prevent capital inflows, would benefit the U.S. economically, but of course it would mean undermining the global leadership role of the U.S.
Thanks. You remind us all of the asymmetric bias of the international monetary system, and you remind me of years of arguments in the G20 and the IMF board that I made urging Germany and others to increase their domestic demand, but we are where we are. Well, let me ask one last question and let you get back to your evening. I think President Xi has suggested China is going to double its GDP by 2035. We've discussed a number of distortions in the economy and efforts to chip away at them. Are you bullish or bearish on China being able to tackle the distortions, and is a doubling of GDP realistic by 2035?
Look, Mark, when you take a systemic point of view and you sort of try to figure out how does it get there, there are really only three ways it can get there, right? The first way is it solves the problem of non-productive investment by discovering a whole new engine of growth into which it can shift domestic investment. They've been talking about that for over a decade and they haven't done that, and it's very hard to do. There's a lot of talk about really sexy stuff like technology and AI, but those are a tiny part of the economy, right? Most Chinese investment is geared towards, you know, guys with shovels and wheelbarrows and stuff like that. So you would really need a massive shift of investment. You'd have to discover a whole new growth engine. But if you do, that would work, because now you could continue growing without the increase in debt. The second way you can pull this off is with a huge increase in domestic consumption, which they've been promising since 2011. The problem there is also an arithmetic problem, and that is that Chinese household consumption is less than 40% of GDP. It was around 38, 39 at the end of last year, and this year, of course, it's lower. I don't know where it's going to come up, but probably 36 to 38% of GDP. The rest of the world is between 60 to 65% of GDP. So there's a huge gap between what is average and where China is. Let's assume that China doesn't completely bridge the gap, but consumption rises by 15 to 20 percentage points of GDP, in which case it'll still be well below the global average, but much higher than it is now. So how do we get there? Well, if I want you to increase your consumption by $100, I'm going to have to give you more than $100, because you'll save part of your increase in income and consume a part of it. But let's assume that by some miracle that doesn't happen. The increase in income is 100% consumed. Well, what that means is that you would have to increase the income of ordinary Chinese by 15 to 20 percentage points of GDP. Now, households retain roughly 50% of GDP, and non-households, which are business and government, retain 50%. So households and non-households are at rough parity. This shift in income, though, requires that households now retain 55 to 60% of GDP, and for non-households to retain whatever the balance is, around 30% of GDP. So we're going from parity to at least two times, right? And where would that difference come from? It shouldn't come from the business sector because they're the best functioning part of the economy. So it basically means a transfer from government to households, a massive transfer. And I would submit to you that when you shift the division of income from parity to households having two times or more than non-households, that that's above all a political shift, and it has significant political implications, and it's quite hard to pull it off. By the way, no country has ever been able to pull off such a major shift in such a short amount of time. But that's the other way you can do it. And then the third way you can do it is you can allow, I've just finished a paper which I'll publish soon, which does the calculations. You can allow debt to GDP. I'm assuming that debt to GDP today is a very high 280%. That's quite conservative. IIF thinks it's 335%. Everybody has their own numbers, but I'm taking the most conservative numbers. And doing that, using my most conservative assumptions, debt would have to be something like 430% of GDP by 2035. Now, no country has ever done that, and certainly no developing country has ever done that. If you believe that's possible, then they can do that. I suspect you don't believe that's possible. I certainly don't think it's possible. But as I see it, those are the three options. You've got to do one of the three. And if you don't do one of the three or some combination, then you simply can't do it. If China were to do it, it would be historically unprecedented, and the arithmetic just doesn't work for me. Again, unless you assume that there is no limit to debt capacity. So that's a long way of saying that, no, I think it'll be extremely difficult for them to do that. And notice that I didn't even mention the demographics, because in 2035, there will be 7% fewer people of working age than there are today. There'll be a bigger population, 1.5% more, but the working population will decline substantially. And so that means your productivity per worker will have to be at least half a percentage point higher than the GDP growth rate. So it's quite difficult to do.
If one theme has come across to me today in this discussion, it's that those who perceive China as a juggernaut vastly underestimate or are not cognizant of the massive economic, financial, and structural challenges facing the country. So I want to let you go back to enjoying it's Beijing evening, and I thank you for this very fascinating, lucid conversation. Thank you, Michael Pettis.